Ready to roll, working fine. Ready to
excellent, excellent, excellent.
Wait, am I allowed to go okay like that now? Is that politically incorrect to do that now?
I have no idea, but it did make me look between into the circle that you made there, just like Derren Brown did.
Oh, yeah, you know, yeah, maybe we should touch on that too, the old mentalism thing.
Yeah, maybe if you just look there.
Okay. Yeah, dude, so Matt Arnold, man, it's been a while since we spoke. No, it actually hasn't. I say that because we actually did meet at the Lincolnshire Poetry a couple of weeks ago.
We did indeed.
What's that, about a month ago now? And
I think it was, yes.
Yeah, that was. I actually really like going there now. There was a whole while, I have to say. For those who obviously are listening in and don't know what that is, it's the Nottinghamshire Pagan Network Moot. So there's a really interesting collection of different people who come together from lots of different faiths, backgrounds, really, who have a different levels of, you know, what their knowledge is, coming to a forum just to come and have a drink and a chat. And it's a nice, interesting gathering, isn't it?
Absolutely, I enjoy it. It's very relaxed. Certainly no babies being sacrificed. Sorry.
No, where do you think? Where do you think that actually comes from? Just that whole baby sacrifice.
I think that comes from the American way of looking at faith that is anything other than Christianity. It generally seems to have a very negative effect towards, especially particularly paganism, and just goes back to the same witch trials and all that sort of stuff. And I think a lot of imagination as well. Everybody loves a good story. All good stories deserve embellishment, as I believe Tolkien said, or at least Gandalf did in the films.
He did, yeah. But no, it's interesting how it's a way to demonize that group you don't want to associate or want them to grow. So what you do, you stick a label on them and you don't allow them to communicate with anybody, or everyone's then afraid to talk to them. And I think that actually that echoes it really way in politicalness. And actually, you see on social media the kind of interesting boundary lines that happen between certain groups of friends, where it's like, I'm not going to talk to that person's a Nazi, or that person's alt-right. And it's like, no, dude, he shared a video from Joe Rogan. What are you on about? Or he's talking about
I have no idea who that is, but yeah, okay.
Like Jordan Peterson or something, or Ben Shapiro. And it's like, no, they're doing like a political commentary. They have a guest on, and some of the viewers might not agree with the fact that he's got that guest on. Yeah, like this, for instance, that can have that kind of effect.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not every day that you see sort of a church minister on the podcast.
No, yeah, and that's...
Without asking for you to give them lots and lots of money for a blessed hanky or something like that.
So the other day I was flicking through TV channels, right, and I came across the God channel. And there's surprising. There's about 10 of them now, actually, on Sky. And there was this one guy. He was sat behind his desk. He looked very regal. He looked at lots of money, and he's like, "You've got a gift to God. You got a gift to God." And it's like, "No, you're asking me to give to you." No.
Absolutely, absolutely. Unfortunately, there are a lot of desperately needy people who watch this sort of stuff and fall into the trap of, "Well, if I give this, I will get something back," and it's all a load of bunkum, really.
So you obviously talk very knowledgeable from that point of view, because you are in fact a Baptist minister? Is that your?
No, that's Peter Laws. That is the only Baptist minister. no, I'm actually an Anglican Church of England. I'm a lay pioneer minister. That means I don't have a dog collar. I haven't gone through the ordination process, and I'm a pioneer. So I do things on the edge and over the edge of church. Deliberately, just because personally I believe that God, the divine, the eternal one, whatever you want to name, works outside of the church as well as inside.
So, and that's an interesting view, isn't it? So the church has a set stringent number of rules, I guess, that it wants you to follow, an order, a way of doing things. But actually, you're a bit like, well, I think we should be doing this bit as well, you know, and this is what I want to incorporate. Is that how you see that?
Well, the two rules really are love God, the divine, the eternal, and love your neighbour as you love yourself. Those are the only two rules. There are a whole pile of man-made rules on top of that, such as the village that I work in, I can't go across the border, which is the river through the middle of the village, just because it's a parish boundary.
You
it's crazy.
Cross the river.
The River Meaden.
You're not allowed to cross the river.
No, don't cross the river unless you've paid the ferryman.
Lay my cross my palm with silver.
Absolutely, yes. Well, we do go across to get the beverages at the pub at the other side.
Is that allowed by the church?
Of course it is, yeah. I mean, I run a community orchard in the village to try and help to bring the community back together. And one of the events that we do is a cider bottling evening from the cider that we brew from the apples that we press about 3 months previous. So we all have a very good time, quality control, testing these things.
Strong cider, weak cider. That's
6% cider.
Oh, nice.
It's smooth.
No, that's cool. But that's a really interesting way to get like a community to come together, isn't it? We produce this locally, you know, come and enjoy what we put together.
Absolutely. And I don't believe you can have a church, a worshipping community of any kind without a community first. Whether it's Christian, pagan, or whatever, you need community. And you build on that for the deeper things for spiritual exploration after that.
Yeah, because I guess you kind of bridge it. So one of the things that I did with you guys about 2014, or maybe 15, I was editing a video for Pagan Pride, and because of course Pagan Pride has stepped away this year for various reasons, mm-hmm. I don't know fully what the reasons are other than their committee put that message out. So I was like, okay, what I should perhaps do is do like a kind of retrospective video, take about 10 minutes, have some clips from each of the festival, go from beginning to end, it looked quite nice, and maybe interject it with some interview segments about, you know, what it's achieved over the years. And of course I came across the multi-faith conversation that happened. And I think I chaired that, and that was really interesting, because there was lots of different people who have very different disciplines who come together just to have a conversation, and that I think is really missing. That doesn't happen.
I don't think there is enough interfaith conversation that takes place, especially between Christians and pagans, for the simple reason that traditionally we've been pitted against each other, often by our own sides, which is really, really sad, because let's face it, we're all trying to explore what is the deeper meaning in life. And we can all learn a lot of things from each other. I've learned so much about my own faith, as well as the pagan faith, by interfacing and journeying alongside pagans.
Yeah, I think there's a cross-pollination of the way that people embrace nature, or embrace themselves, their culture, their community, that happens. That
absolutely. And the natural world is something that we've all got in common anyway. So, you know, and we've all got to look after it, because we've all got to live here.
Yeah, I think you said it really well then. We all share the same space. We've got to have a conversation. And I think that there's certain fear blocks in there. That's a different group. I mean, where I work in a very diverse, multicultural, multi-faith, ethnic, diverse area. That you see the divide lines that are created by themselves in the way that they talk, the way that they address people, the things they say, the standards they maintain, and they kind of exclude themselves from having that discussion.
I think a lot of it is fear. That stems from ignorance about the other.
Yeah.
And part of my role has been to actually investigate the other, find out what is it that pagans really do believe, as opposed to what a Christian who's wrote a book says that maybe they say that they were an ex-Satanist or an ex-witch or whatever. But I think a lot of that comes with some baggage that somebody who's, say, an ex-smoker has a vehemency against cigarettes. And a lot of stuff can be misconstrued and misunderstood when you're engaged with it. So when you come out of it, if you don't understand what you're doing, then, you know, you can have a skewed view, which then you unfortunately get a platform to be able to, you know, everybody loves the converted story of somebody that came from the other side. So they get put on a plinth, and then it's very difficult to unpick exactly what was going on in the past, because your story reinforces itself as you tell it more often.
Yeah, of course. I mean, because me, I guess I had a bit like yourself. I came into it from more, not essentially a faith point of view. I came into it, it's a really interesting space to go and learn. rather than I want to observe, I want to become pagan. I'm certainly not pagan in that sense, but I do observe the wheel of the year. I understand the transitions that we see in the sky. I understand how the earth and the sky relationship is together. I can observe that, and I think that's a very fundamental thing we could all do. And now that, so I think I'm kind of I would almost say I'm a atheist pagan in that sense.
That makes a lot of sense. You can do that.
But to say that, they look at you like, you've got two heads. What are you on about?
Well, the Lincolnshire Poacher's beer is quite strong.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Nice.
I mean, I observe the Wheel of the Year as well. I've written on my blog about the Wheel of the Year. I interface it with Christianity because we both, as I say, share the same planet, the same sun, moon, stars, and so on. Some of the work that I've done is fed into the Moon Museum, which appeared a 7-meter diameter moon hanging from Leicester Cathedral right in the middle of the nave, which was an amazing thing in itself. But to be able to work through the cycle of the moon with 5 meditation stations for the different phases of the moon, and then be able to put a spin that is not exclusively Christian, but actually inclusive. It meant that actually underneath that moon, we were able to celebrate a waning moon ritual because it was just the time of the lunar cycle. And we got pagans and Christians and interested parties underneath this 7-meter diameter moon in Leicester Cathedral, all giving over the things that we wanted to get rid of in our lives and taking on new things because of the waning moon phase.
Yeah, because I guess I would, maybe I have a little ignorance about certain faiths. Not that it's just my ignorance only because I just don't know. So I'm saying that in the word that I don't understand fully. Say with Islam, I understand right now it's Ramadan, and which actually is a celebration from a moon cycle, from a new moon to a new moon, and how powerful
yes.
that is for them.
Yes, I mean the ancient faiths, most of them are lunar based. In the Judeo-Christian and Islamic culture, you will find that the lunar stuff that I do was born out of the fact that Christianity comes from a Judaic historic background, and the Judaic way of looking at the months was the astronomers look for the crescent of the moon, and then when they would see that, the first crescent, they would go and report back to the high priest. The high priest would say, yep, it's the beginning of the month, everyone. And that was called Rosh Chodesh. And even in the Christian times, the early Christian times, you've got the guy, the writer, St. Paul, who says, don't let anybody look down on you for your Sabbath and new moon festivals. So for me, that was, actually, we have a license to celebrate that. And there is something cathartic about giving over your stuff at the right time of the month. And at the new moon, dedicating the month ahead to what the plans that you've got.
Yeah. It's symbolic because it sits in the sky. Everyone can see it. Everyone can relate to it. And the story that goes with it then becomes cross-cultural. It becomes cross-people. And the message what everyone should be doing, perhaps, is the same regardless of where you are in the world. Because we're all seeing the same thing in the sky. Therefore, the stories what are told, potentially, are kind of the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how did you... So you have your orchard... Sorry. My mistake. New Forest Church. I don't think I've ever pressed you on the conversation.
New Forest. There's a New Forest Church. That's not me that runs that.
Okay.
That's a guy, David Cole, down in the New Forest, funnily enough. But Forest Church itself has been going since 2012. It's a movement of not just, isn't it nice to be an eco-Christian? But it's actually moving from just being a, well, you've got these four levels. You've got the dominion level, which is what a lot of Christians have, you know, have this dominion, and that can lead to all sorts of things like, well, the earth's going to burn, so what's the point looking after it? So we have dominion, and they take a very negative approach to dominion rather than a positive approach, where a good king would look after its subjects. So there's the dominion approach, which most Christians use. Then you've got the stewardship approach as well, that a lot of Christians do use, where you actually look after the planet because we are told to look after the planet. And that's a great thing in itself. And then you've got
down the other levels, I forget off the top of my head, but you get to the lowest level of all, which is participant. You are a part of the ecosystem. You are part of the worldwide, the web of interconnectedness. And so therefore, when we worship in the amongst the trees themselves worship as well. And the ground and the rocks and the sky and the sea, all are worshipping the Eternal One, the Maker. And that's what we just join in with. And the reason why we look after the planet and we get involved in environmental things is not because it's a good thing and we all share the same place, which is good in itself, but actually because it's part of a worship.
No, I think I understand that. That's one of the questions I wanted to put by you, because I hear that often when we're in a larger kind of group, you talk a lot about the forest and the connections and how that is similar to how pagans worship. And they would obviously go out to the woods, they would go to circles, they would find sacred places, and they would enjoy their celebration with the sky and the earth, and they'll call to the quarters, as it were, and they want to share their world with nature. And I see that's very similar. It almost feels counterintuitive that there isn't more conversation.
Well, these things take time, and I would say that the church is like an oil tanker. It takes a long time to turn. But turn is happening. People are using their little rudders to shift things. It's a process.
Going through these videos, right, I was editing, and I came across another interest that you have, because you're a teacher by education and by career, right? Mm-hmm. You also are a science teacher, is that correct?
I was a head of physics at the Minster School in Southwell for 10 years. I've got a deep interest in physics and chemistry as well, really. I was trained as a chemical engineer and chemical and mineral engineering background.
So you have a real kind of understanding of the things that you touch and feel, and you go, I know how this works, I can throw this, I understand the maths and perhaps would go into that. So that gives you rather a deeper connection to what it is that's happening around you.
Absolutely. I mean, the seat that I'm sitting on and you're sitting on at the moment, we're actually not touching it. We're about a millionth of a millimetre hovering above it. Give or take a few millionths of a millimetre. But most of it is empty space. I'd say, when I used to teach the kids, I'd say, everything that you see is 99.99999999999999% empty space. You've got the electrons whizzing around, the protons around, and the neutrons in the center of the atom. But even those are just elemental bits of quarks and the combinations and so on. So everything is empty space, including the chair you're sitting on, including the table that my desk is, my laptop's on, and including the thing that is inside here. Everything is empty space, pretty much. But yet, permeating all through that is the Creator keeping it and upholding it and making it happen. So the idea that God is this wispy, weird, beardy creature that sits on a cloud or is at the farthest ends of regions of space, it's completely bonkers, because the immanence of God is, and when I use the word God, by the way, I'm not talking about a male necessarily, I'm talking about male and female fullness, rather than specific gendered.
I see. When you say gendered God, I still think the word God potentially is the name of a species of God, rather than a name of a gender of that cat, shall we say.
We could go into a very, very long conversation about the Divine Council and El Elyon, the Most High, and the various concepts of what levels there are within even Christianity, because Christianity just has this idea of Elohim being the Creator. And that's okay if it's capital E, but there are other Elohim as well, gods, sons of gods, spirits, human spirits as well are called Elohim. So throughout the Bible, if you look at it from the Hebrew point of view, you will see there are other gods, but there is one Creator that made the others.
Okay, because I think that's perhaps where it gets a bit crazy, doesn't it? So I think it's in more recent additions and more recent changes, such as like there's been the new Millennium Edition that's happened a few months ago, 10 years ago actually, where they've sought to make more versions, so make more names of the word God in there to be always be Lord or God. And I can remember reading that excerpt and going, but in the older versions, there's more text, more words of description of who he is or who this individual is now, you're synchronizing them to be one word. Aren't we therefore losing the definition of the Bible by changing them all to be the same?
I don't know that particular version myself. I'd known that a G-O-D in the Bible, the translations that I've used, I use the NRSV, which is an academic level accepted version. God means, I think I've got this right, Yahweh, Y-H-W-H, the sacred name of the Eternal One that the Hebrews used, whereas Lord is Adonai. I can't exactly remember. I've forgotten off the top of my head, but they do mean different things. You've got a duality of the Yahweh. There's a guy called Michael Heiser who looks at the two Yahwehs. He's an academic way. He's a brain scholar, and he can take you down the two Yahwehs route.
I actually might tap him up actually and go, explain this to me, I don't understand.
Oh, there's loads of YouTube clips he does.
Oh, I'll definitely check those out. But again, this I guess rolls into the other things that you've been doing, so the physics side. And then mm-hmm. you take great pleasure in doing mentalism.
yes, mentalism. That started really from a Christian perspective of looking at a chap called Derren Brown, who is, if you're not in the UK, he's a very well-known mentalist. A mentalist, when you boil it down, is an information thief. We will steal information from you and we will play it back to you as if, you know, we've got some superpowers. We haven't, we're just very good at information theft, which is what Derren Brown does. But I started off looking to understand, is Derren Brown in touch with something dark and demonic when he's doing all of his stuff, or is he a charlatan, just a magician basically? Well, he is a very, very, very good charlatan.
He is, and he's very honest about being dishonest.
Absolutely, and I love him to bits.
Yeah, me too. I really like his approach to stuff. And in one of his documentaries, he says, "Oh, if you've bought my book, actually, it shows you don't have much self control." I'm like, "Shit, I have three of them."
Yeah, I've got some of his books. I've also got his magicianship level books as well. Pure Effect is a very, very good book for teaching you how to create and craft mentalism. And I think for me, that's what I prefer. It's the art form of magic. And when I use magic, I mean non-spiritual magic. I just mean stage illusion type stuff.
Yeah, I had I did a video about a year ago, actually, and it was about... I'd attended a deliverance service, right?
So, okay.
And I, obviously, being a martial artist, as I have been since I was like a teenager, I was very interested in still looking at some of the stuff online. I came across a martial art called EFO, which is very shaky martial art. They're using lots of what I thought was mentalism techniques, where they were pushing people around a room. It looked very much like the deliverance services, you know, where they're casting and people are falling over and flailing all over the place. And I was like, mm-hmm. That's the same thing that's happening. These people who are going to this martial arts seminar, who are being trained by these men, who are telling them to fall over when they touch them, push them over, I'm going, that's exactly the same thing.
There's a lot of things like NLP triggers and anchors and that sort of stuff that's going on within even in church services. And I've seen... cold reading being used as well. And if there's a guy called Ian Rowland, his Full Facts of Cold Reading is a brilliant book. And it looks at how you can use sleight of mouth, which is an interesting concept, to create stuff. So for instance, I went to a healing conference and the guy at the front was saying, let's do a practical, okay? I'm getting a word that there's somebody here who's got a pain in their left side. And like, okay, let's just run with this. And nobody responded. So in mentalism terms, that's called a miss. So then he forked another mentalism term. So he backed up and he went down another track, which was, well, actually, you're facing me, so it will be on your right-hand side. And I was like, okay, this is a complete scam here. I'm sorry, but I believe that God heals, and I've seen it happen. But I also believe that God gives us common sense and helps us to spot when we've got things that are being abused. And that's what I hate the most.
That's a really interesting... it definitely is a mentalism technique, how you can flip it over when it isn't. And I'm still right, because I'm the one who knows what I'm doing.
Absolutely. I've run bets where I've put £300 on the table and bet somebody that they will say something. And through a process of word manipulation, sleight of mouth, been able to save my £300 every single time. It's great fun.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, I got into mentalism via my interest in the unexplained and the paranormal, because when I was attending, I attended a National Spiritualist Union church, an SNU church, for around about 6 months. I was invited to go along, and it was like a group gathering. It used to happen at Canning Circus, which is the oldest SNU church in the country, where they teach mentalism, where they teach mediumship. And I kind of wanted to go into that, but have a knowledge of illusion and have a knowledge of what it is that I'm looking at. So I wasn't skeptical. I was willing and on board to take lessons and understand what was going on. But in doing so, I kind of learned how to fake it. So, and then I did. I went to a mind, body, and spirit fair for a day, and I faked being a medium. And I actually really felt guilty by lunchtime that I had already taken about £200 from people, and they had gone away being so happy. And I actually, you know, guilt kind of touched me, and I was like, I have to go and find these people who are still here and actually give them their money back. Because I generally felt I had conned them. I'd given them a reading that was very good. They were very happy. What I'd actually really done is that I'd read back to them what it is they were telling me while using a kind of script that I had kind of memorized and a bit of patter that I had come. And when you work in the customer environment, you develop those skills naturally. So I kind of invited all that together, and it was very easy to take money from people, and that's what I was like, shit, this actually is very scary.
Absolutely. I mean, Darren Brown, I think, worked with Richard Dawkins on something called, I think it was Enemies of Reason. It was a TV program. And he went into a mind-body spirit fair. He actually went into, I think it was Newark Mind-Body Spirit Fair about 10 years ago, and they did some filming. And he was showing how some of these people were using cold reading techniques to be able to pretend that they're talking to their dead aunt, or to be able to give them a reading from tarot cards and so on and so forth. It can be an incredibly powerful tool, but it can also be very, very powerfully misused, especially when it comes to gaining money.
It is, yeah, and that's where the guilt by 11:30, I'd been there, it had only opened at 10, and I already earned £200. And people are like, oh, he's really good, and they're passing a message on. I'm going, this isn't kind of what I wanted, because I was quite worried that people are not going, sharing my name out and going, oh, he's a great medium, he's a psychic, and I'm like, fuck no, man. I'm just here to prove that it's that easy.
When we were at the Lincolnshire Poacher at the NPN Moots last time, and I did a mind reading exercise.
You did, yes.
I showed you a particular routine that I do, and I did it a couple of times. The techniques that I used were different because I never want to repeat the same trick twice. So I used techniques differently just because I know that you've got eagle eyes. And nobody spotted it. But I tell you what, if I'd been standing up there with robes and being able to have the right environment, the right pumping music and so on and so forth, I could have actually started a cult.
That's what happens. That's how people, they gain that notoriety. They become a showman. They have to keep doing it. They become very proud. And then people start, I wouldn't say they worship them. They idolize them. They want to become that character. And you find that a lot, I would say, in the spiritualist community, in the kind of a self-esteem movement as well, where there's like, oh, this person's great. I feel so esteemed when I watch this person. I will keep giving them money and I will feel self-esteem. As such, you're feeding that.
And that's exactly what's going on with the TV evangelists on your God channel. Sorry, not your God channel. The God channel you were watching. That's what's going on. There's just the right psychological manipulation to be able to take money from people. And it's disgusting.
I don't mind what people follow. That's not like push it in a negative way. Like, and give people the opportunity to learn and understand. But when it comes to give me money because I want a new jet, as the quite famous one is going around.
Oh, we absolutely.
It just gets a really... Man. I think that for me, there's an ethical, moral dilemma that should be happening if you are in need of a faith, which talks about living in poverty.
Yes. I mean, we've had an incident where we are at the moment in Mansfield Woodhouse that went out on the BBC, where people were being manipulated for money. It was as simple as that. They were being manipulated for money. People were being driven to cash points to give, and it all collapsed. It's wherever you see money becoming the focus, that's when you have to start all the alarm bells going off. Otherwise, it's just going to end messy for you.
Well, the one thing I do find really interesting, I think we actually touched on it when we spoke, is that the guy or the girl who becomes that focus of attention, that showman, that person who's on stage, getting lots of money, getting the attention, literally, by their perhaps of their own faith, they feel that they are becoming more enriched with the power of God or a higher power. So actually, their character becomes more so. And yes. I was going to say, I let you interject there.
No, it's okay. I mean, ego is a powerful thing. And for me, in a biblical sense of it, it's made the actual eternal one become greater and my ego diminish. Not that it goes completely, but actually, you know, it's not about me all the time. It's actually about loving your neighbor as yourself. You've got to love yourself.
Yes.
But not to the exclusion of your neighbor. And you've got to love your neighbor. That's what it's all about. As Bill and Ted said, Jesus got it 2,000 years previous, but Bill and Ted said, be excellent to each other.
That's as simple as that is. That's kind of how I talk to people. I talk to people in a way that gives them, you know, an uplift, makes them feel good and positive, and let us talk. You know, I don't care what it is you want to talk about. Let's go with it. And that's how Absolutely. That's how I talk and approach other people. be excellent to each other. Actually, it's probably the most underlining feeling of that.
Yeah, which is why I do what I do with interfaith dialogue, because actually being excellent means listening, using your ears twice as much as your mouth, and actually, what can I learn from somebody else? What can I learn about the divine, the eternal one, in the life of somebody else who is worshipping or practicing in a different way?
Yes. So the one I was leading a bit, in all fairness, in regards to someone who's a showman on stage. Where I was going to go with that is the deliverance service that I attended.
Yes, that's interesting.
So I can't remember where the church was. It was on Mansfield Road, I believe it was. And this guy had come into my workplace, and he had a gold suit on, you know, really, really well tailored gold suit. So I was helping on the checkouts this day. I was literally covering a break or whatever. So it's a little while ago, and he comes through, and I could tell that he had this rich enthusiasm. He was very happy. He was very confident. He clearly was very rich because he got a gold suit on. So I says, man, what is it you're doing today, my friend? And he goes, oh, man, my name is Ezekiel. Thank you very much for talking to me. You know, thanks for taking the moment to talk to me about faith and God. What are you doing today? And I says, well, I'll tell you what, let me finish work and I'll talk to you. And he goes, okay, then on tonight at 6 o'clock, I'm giving a deliverance service at this church. And I'm like, a deliverance service? I'm going.
I wish I'd been there.
Oh, man, so... You know, far be it from me to say, I was the only white guy in the room.
In the middle of where? Nottingham.
So I kind of stood out a bit. It's like going into a local barber's in Hyson Green. I did stand out a bit, but actually that allowed me to talk to people, because they were like, why are you here? And I'm like, well, I'm here to learn about your faith. I'm here to understand. So... This particular person, this Ezekiel, had an assistant with him who looked like somewhere between, I couldn't work out whether his wife, his girlfriend, or kind of a PA kind of character. And she was pushing the trolley as he was kind of leaving the checkout. And we shared notes, but he gave me his number and whether he was going to be that night. And I then, after work, I went to that deliverance service. And it was very charismatic. It was very powerful. Everyone was very moved. There was about 200 people in this room. And clearly people had paid to come here. There was buses outside, where people had obviously got on a coach or whatever and come to this venue to see this guy. So I didn't know where he came from, but clearly he was very powerful and very moving in their community. So it was at this point, I noticed on the front row, the lady who was his assistant in shopping was in a wheelchair. So you probably know.
I can see where this is going.
You can probably see where this is going to go, right? So he was he did this whole like service. He was asking to talk to God. Everyone was like raising their hands in the air, and actually there really, really was a good vibe in the air. Everyone was really happy. Everyone was really conversational. It looked like everyone was almost channeling God, because they weren't talking to God. They were talking to the Holy Spirit. You know, that's who they were communicating to.
Which technically, from my perspective, it's
might
God,
be the same thing.
I'm a Trinity.
Of the Trinity, that's how they were coming down. Where they went from there, it was his assistant was like, "Oh, come here if you want a miracle. Come on stage. The Holy Spirit is here." And there was a number of people who came through. But then they got to this particular woman, and she was a very struggling lady. And I was like, that's not the person I saw earlier. The person I saw earlier was pushing a trolley absolutely fine. This particular woman was struggling to walk. She had a wheelchair, and someone helped her out of the chair. There was an assistant each side. And then he put his hand on her head. The power of God talked through him. And she fell on the floor, and then she started flailing around a bit. And then she got up and then was walking around and started dancing on stage. And I'm like, I've just watched a con happen.
Absolutely. I
watched the convincer happen to this crowd of people who, you know, they were already heavily invested, but you're preaching to the crowd here. And then everyone was like, wow, this is a miracle. This person can walk again. And of the biggest one that night, that was the biggest one. The truth is that person was already with him, and that was probably something going on.
And the fact that we're having this conversation actually goes to show that what's the end product of that? Well, you've got some people going away happy, but actually you've got some people who are thinking about these things seriously and going, no, this isn't right. This is just a complete con, as you say.
It is. Due to the area that I work in, there's a lot of evangelical-type churches and Pentecostal churches that are developing, and they appear to be almost like focal points of the community, which is great. It gets people to come to faith, whatever. But it appears to also be a con in and of itself.
That's a huge topic in itself,
yeah.
As to what's going on under the bonnet of all of that sort of stuff, because it would just be too big to unpack that.
Fair enough.
Really. But what is interesting is I'm going to the Midlands Deliverance Conference tomorrow. Ooh. I'm going down tonight with my wife. I'm actually recording this in her offices, which is a bit of a sneaky. It's the only place where I
was
don't
looking
really...
at all the boxes behind you, Gavin. What is this?
Yeah.
It's a story.
Yeah, I've seen the episode on the telly where the chap's having his interview and his kids come running in the background. I just didn't want that, so I snuck off into my wife's office.
It's that little like the lady who comes in and, like, on hands and knees and comes across the room.
Yeah, except these would be a big lumping 15-year-old chap running in. But anyway, so I'm in the offices of the Church's Fellowship for Psychical and Spiritual Studies. My wife's the general secretary for it. And we're both going down tonight to stop over to get ready for the Midlands Deliverance Conference tomorrow, which is put on for deliverance ministers. Now, one of the things in the Church of England in particular is that deliverance ministry is very, very, very tightly regulated. Ever since the Barnsley case, where somebody had effectively ripped off the face of their wife after they thought that they'd been exorcised from every demon, apart from the demon of murder, apparently, which they left them with, which was peculiar. But anyway, since that happened, and there was a lot of kickback from the Church of England.
Yeah, so when was that?
That, I think it was 1973. It's called the Barnsley case. My wife will be able to tell you a lot more, and Google will as well.
Okay.
Ever since then, the Church of England's regulated, so you only have one deliverance minister per diocese, per area of the country. And they have a team, including psychologists as well, so that they're able to tell whether somebody or not's got a mental issue, or is it something that's a bit deeper as well. And they're able to be interconnected with mental health services and so on. So it isn't a showcase. One of the things about deliverance is that it isn't to put on stage. And the reason why I call it deliverance is because since that film came out called The Exorcist, people have this idea of exorcism as being head spinning, pea soup flying, and all that sort of stuff. Deliverance, when it happens, is a very quiet thing. It's a personal thing between you, the person who's praying with you or people that are praying with you. And it isn't something to put on stage and mock in the way that you've seen it being mocked. I think there was a guy called Bob Larson who brought his daughters over a few years ago, and he was showing people deliverance ministry, and it was all done on stage. No. That's just the showman.
I emailed Bob Larson about 5 years ago, and I got a reply, actually.
Wow.
I did. I got a personal reply from him, and this actually was before his daughters kind of took over the center stage, actually. So, actually, it's probably a bit older than 5 years. So I emailed him, and I was like, I'm really interested in your deliverance services. You know, I'm here in Nottingham in the UK. He says, well, that's fantastic, you know, because in Nottingham, one of my, I don't think he used the word lieutenant, but that's the word that came to mind. One of my kind of like well-trained guys actually lives in Nottingham, and he has a deliverance service that, and that's based in the Meadows area of the city. And he gave me his contact details. Now, when I followed that up, actually, and they were running a service every Wednesday evening doing deliverance services. But again, it was very low key compared to how Bob was running it. But yeah, I did go along and I did see that guy. It was an interesting conversation. I mean, clearly Bob is, he's made for television. This guy is an absolute guy made for television. This is the guy you want to see. And his daughters are extremely beautiful, and they carry his method through now. But of course, he's obviously got a lot of criticism from people who go along to these circles and can't talk to him. And he basically has screened guests who come in and do his thing. And I guess if you are putting on a show as opposed to deliverance, you know, maybe that's why.
Well, yeah, and deliverance isn't a very short thing. Oh, it can be, but often there's a journey that has to be taken with the person, because you do need to understand the psychological things that are going on as well. What is their lifestyle like? What things are they taking? What medicines are they taking, as well as prescribed and unprescribed ones? And also there's the aftercare, because you've got a person who's in a very vulnerable place, and you need to care for them, not just to have them on stage and zap them. You have to actually, it's about loving the person as a whole, rather than just loving them for that moment in time when you can get them on stage and look good to people. So I would say that for me, deliverance ministry, I can't personally do because I'm not ordained. But I have a deep interest in it, and to the point where my master's dissertation will be looking at deliverance ministry.
So from a Christian, like a Church of England perspective, what is the criteria to become a, I hate to use the word exorcist, what is that?
Well, first off, you've got to be ordained. So you've got to go done your theological college, you've got your dog collar and so on. And then I think you just don't have to be in the room when they need one, when they vote someone into the place. I think that's slightly tongue-in-cheek, but the deliverance minister, the exorcist, was often the lowest office within the church. And it was the one that nobody wanted to do, because it is very draining, and because you're dealing with a lot of psychologically needy people, a lot of spiritually needy people as well. And that can be a very big drain.
Yeah.
And you also are dealing with stuff that is beyond what science can currently explain. And that's a whole other ball game with the paranormal side of things.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that the unexplained and the paranormal, which I guess has been my kind of interest for, since I was a kid. Because I guess from my interest, I was really I've told the story a few times. My mum had some books on the Bermuda Triangle when I was like 4 or 5 years old. This book was like thick as hell. I remember reading it and being absolutely fascinated by the stories of the Bermuda Triangle. Then there was this book called Mystic Places, which is by Reader's Digest. And here's me, 8 years old, going to school with this book that looked like it was like it belongs in a museum. silver pages, you know, beautiful artwork inside. And it kind of covered like the whole spectrum of this, of the supernatural, the unusual, and the unexplained. Everything from UFOs, abductions, time slips, the ancient alien hypothesis in the form of that casket cover that has a gentleman who appears to have African style licks in the face, but appears to be sitting on a rocket. This thing is like 3,000 years old, and what could this possibly mean? And The Hollow Earth theory from the guys back in the 1800s who found that the tunnel was into Antarctica, but their ship was too big because the masts were too high. So a whole spectrum of stuff. And here's me, 8 years old, just completely absorbing this. And I wanted to get into Egyptology and so on, so I started learning how to read hieroglyphics. I started interested into the esoteric and the occult and so on. So that's kind of been with me for a long time. As such, it's fed my curiosity about the world, hence Curious World.
Absolutely.
Just because there's so many things that are going on in people, or with people, and the kind of strange, weird, quirky things that are happening in the world.
Indeed. I mean, when I talk to people, everybody's got a story of either a personal encounter or they know somebody in their family who's had an encounter with something that is spooky, for want of a better word.
There's some times, man. I don't confess this to too many people, and here's this going to go out to quite a few people. I am almost worried how many things I've seen and experienced that makes me go, that ain't right. Some people are talking about one thing, I've got a list.
and yet you're an atheist.
I know.
There's hope.
It's probably because I put myself on the rational list first. I'm trying to approach things from a vision of a rational based understanding before I start proclaiming that I've seen, you know, who knows what. Because I don't know.
And that's exactly how I approach things as well. The Sherlock Holmes approach: you eliminate the obvious,
yeah,
and you whittle it down through science, and then eventually you get to the stage where there's something that you just cannot explain. Now, that could be because science doesn't yet understand it,
yeah,
or it could be because it's outside of the limits of the scientific method, for instance.
Yeah. So that's why I became a member of Society for Psychical Research, I became a member of ASSAT, which is the Association of the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. So it really, hard roll of the tongue. But it means I get to access to science papers and stuff that's actually being done in an academic field. In those fields, and also I get to communicate to a lot of really interesting people. Should I need to tap up an expert, I can.
Yes, and I'm a member of SPR as well. I joined, I think it was October last year, so I'm still sort of like wading my way through stuff there. But the academic side of things is what I'm really interested in, because there's a lot of woo-woo stuff out there, and actually we need to cut the fluff on both sides. You know, it's not, we've said Christians can have a lot of woo-woo stuff, and we've explained that, described a lot of stuff, but pagans can have a lot of woo-woo stuff as well, and actually we need to cut that stuff away. I did chemical and mineral engineering. I took the mineral engineering third year option because I like minerals. They're beautiful shapes and sizes, and we use crystals, we use quartz for digital watches, and yep, silicon chips for timing for microprocessors and stuff. So they have a use, but some people go overboard and put the word quantum in it, for instance, and then suddenly you can sell it as
a
new gimmick.
I have this stargaze around me, it connects to my chakra, I was like, fuck off.
Well, I mean, I don't know. There might be energy points within the body that science hasn't explained yet, but
maybe.
I wouldn't dismiss it straight away like that. But I do understand what you're saying, yes.
Yeah, when they start telling what you say is it quantum entanglement, it's like, let's just push the boat out to include another word on the scientific spectrum so it looks like I know what I'm talking about.
And well, when I was at a mind body spirit festival and I was going around, you could buy these little triangular metal things that you could put on your mobile phone that would completely block any electromagnetic radiation. And I'm thinking, hold on a second, mobile phones run on microwaves, different frequency microwaves are the one that cook food.
Yep.
But they run on the microwave frequencies. If they're part of the electromagnetic spectrum, if you put that on your phone and it really does work, your phone won't work.
Yeah, there's a device that I had a guest on a little while ago called Holly, Holly Page, who's a neurologist actually, and but part of her thing is that she sold many different things, and on her website she sells I think it's called Blue View. That has you, it's like a little, almost like a USB dongle. And you put it in your laptop or in your PC, and it stops Wi-Fi being around it, or it stops Wi-Fi being in your house, and then going, how does that work?
It's called a Faraday cage.
Well, that's the only way to stop it, really. So I was just like scratching my head how this device works. I still debate whether to buy one, actually, see if it does work. But I'm sure there must be a communication where it actually just turns the Wi-Fi signal off in the device itself, rather than actually blocking the sphere around it.
I wouldn't know. I've not seen it. I'm going to leave you for that legal fun.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to have some fun with that, man. Wait, so you do see these kind of interesting devices like that little triangle that blocks your mobile phone signal from hurting your brain. It's almost like selling a trinket that, you know, has a promise, but you can't be sure it's actually not doing it.
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of wishful thinking that goes on in this placebo effect and all of that. And we know the placebo effect does work.
Yes.
But the placebo effect is very different to something saying this blocks all electromagnetic frequencies, and when it clearly doesn't.
Yes, because you're making a bold statement, and it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the last journal from ASAP, I discovered the nocebo effect, which is I don't know what actually what it. What it referred to, and I was thinking it doesn't play into it because I couldn't remember what it's called.
I think is it something to do with when you tell somebody they're having a placebo and it still works anyway?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I'm just actually trying to bring up its etymology now. The nocebo effect is said to occur when negative expectations of the patient regarding a treatment cause the treatment to have a negative effect than it otherwise would have. And there was a the flip side is the placebo effect. The nocebo effect is perhaps the medicine does work, but you don't believe it does, and thus has an effect that nullifies it.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an old trick that you can go and went into work and you can just say, oh, you look a bit peaky today. Are you feeling all right? And then everybody else in the office is in on it and they make the same comments to the person. And then by the end of the day, the person's feeling rotten.
Yeah, it's this whole like... when you find that someone's looking at you and you start noticing it over the course of the day, and then you start, oh, they're a psychic vampire and they absorb my energy. And it's like,
oh, the Rupert Sheldrake thing, the feeling of being stared at or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember his book.
I still wonder what stock there is in that, actually, because the thing is, you are looked at all the time and you don't find yourself going, because you can't.
Well, we tried this in the Lincolnshire Poacher, didn't we? And we just stared at this one bloke, and he just didn't turn around.
No, he didn't.
Oh, well.
Because do you feel like when you know that someone's perhaps watching you, then you become, if you're aware of it, then you become, what does he want? What's the knowledge? What are they trying to gain? Are they trying to make me feel bad? As you go through the questions, it makes you more notice them more. So, but the thing is, if you don't notice it,
I think there's, you see, we've, from my own perspective, we've got soul man, soul man, and we've had this concept that the soul resides within the bounds of the body, but actually, what if the soul is bigger than the body? And that means then that our soul extends out further, and somebody else's soul can extend out further, and there's that interaction between the two when they touch, in inverted commas. And is that what's going on for this whole sense of, oh, there's somebody close to me and not? And then does that feed into things like where you are in a place that is supposed to be haunted, say, or where there has been an experience, and you go in not knowing that? And that's important because of psychological priming.
Sure.
And you feel the sense that there is something there. Because that's where my in came in through the whole of this paranormal stuff. I went into a room where I was expecting just to pick up a video lead from the back of a telly for something for downstairs for a friend. And I went into that room and it was, bump, whoa, you are not welcome here. And that was like, I don't understand this, but I'm just going to go and get this DVD. And I remember just running to the telly and the DVD, flicking it round and just going, I want to get out. And at that point, I couldn't see the door because it was recessed in a little alcove. And I thought to myself, now I've hit panic mode, and I just got out as fast as I could. But I went into that room nonchalant, didn't know any priming. When I went downstairs, the mum whose daughter's room it was that I'd gone into to get that lead, she said, did you feel anything in that room? And I said, no, because I hadn't got a clue what had gone on. But I spoke to somebody afterwards and they said, yeah, actually, they've been playing around with stuff, summoning stuff up. And for me, if I'd have gone in knowing that that they'd been doing that already into that room and experienced that. I would have personally put that down to psychological expectation priming, but I didn't. And that for me was more of a convincer that there is something other out there.
That's really what was coming to me then was I've been in that situation myself, actually, with that kind of experience happening. And there was a more primed one that I had. So about 5 years ago, this lady contacted me from Clifton, and she was like, "My son tells me there's something in his bedroom. I don't know what to do. I saw your article in the Evening Post. Maybe I can talk to you about it. Can you come round?" And I'm like, "All right, okay." So I go to her house, and what she had described is that her son said that there was a person who lives in her wardrobe, lives in the wardrobe and sometimes lives in the bed. It sleeps with the son and keeps him warm at night. And this is what the son has told her. And then when someone else comes into the room, whatever it is jumps through the window and stays in the tree. And then when that person leaves, it jumps back in. So I'm like, what? Okay, let's go with this experience. Let's do what they're saying. And so with no real understanding of what I'm looking at, I'm kind of walking around this room and doing the TV stuff, and I'm doing a bit of measuring of... I didn't really know what I really was measuring, but there was fluctuations in the room in terms of temperature. There was the EMF meter that I had at the time. Again, it's an EMF meter. What am I really measuring? I don't really know. I'm more rational these days. but I could see at the time it had some interesting measurements that were coming up. So I think maybe it's the TV. Maybe there's a light fitting underneath the room. Maybe they've got like these new lights that are under the floor, like in the kitchen below, and that's just reaching to the kid being set on the floor or whatever. I don't know. So to appease the lady, and I thought to put her mind at ease, I said, "What we'll do, we'll close the door, we'll do our thing, and that should be fine for you." Just to kind of give her a psychological feeling that everything is going to be okay. That felt like the right thing to do at that time. Which is what we did, and when we had done that, we spent like about 5-10 minutes on the floor. Me and Sylvia, we sat there, we talked, and we asked whatever was there, just, you know, "Thank you very much, you know, times move on," kind of thing, just to give that impression. I really felt that's what we were doing. When we spoke to the son, who then came home from school that day, he says that what it was now feels happy and can now leave the tree. And it was like, what?
Okay.
He says it's very happy. He can now leave the tree. He's just saying this kid's about 7.
Mm-hmm. And he had no idea that you'd been going around doing stuff in that room.
No, but we spoke about what was happening. So, so again, from the kid's perspective, the kid said to me, "He comes through a portal in the floor." Which is an interesting term for a child to say in the first place. Mm-hmm. So he says, he comes from a portal in the floor, and he plays with me. He gets into bed with me at night, but when people come in, he jumps out and jumps to the window into the tree. And take the child at face value. This is what the parent told me initially, then the son had also said the same thing to me. But he says the portal's closed now. And again, that he said that the spirit had told him to tell me that.
Hmm. I mean, that's interesting. It comes through the floor. First off, I'm reminded of Jamie and the Magic Torch. But that aside, my middle son, we were going through an experience of a lot of electrical issues, things blowing all at the same time, things that weren't connected to the mains blowing as well. And he said that he saw something, a little pink goblin-y type thing, just rise up out the floor, look at him, and then go back in. And he was absolutely scared silly. And one of the things, he wouldn't go back into his bedroom to sleep. So whether or not he'd been, you know, he'd seen something, or whether or not it was just his imagination, whatever it had, it had affected him and it needed healing. He needed some help. So I gave him a little holding cross. We prayed with him. I did some anointing oil on his forehead, just because I know that this sort of thing works, whether it's pure psychology or whether there's something else that's going on a spiritual level. I think it's both. He then was just happy to go straight back into that room again. We prayed around the room.
I think there's a reinforcement of, oh, it's going to be okay now. I'm going to be happy, which is rather, kind of really what we did for the mother, is we almost kind of acted effectively. This is what we felt mm-hmm. was the right thing to do. And it kind of felt like I was being led by intuition to do that. And then it all seemed to be okay. It all seemed to be groovy. And then I contacted about 3 or 4 days later. No child's going back to bed at night, isn't saying these things anymore. Everything's happy, everything's good.
And yeah, it's one of the things that they say about in deliverance ministry is you never leave without doing at least something.
Yeah.
Even if it's just a prayer, you never leave a place or a person without something being done, and because it seems to work. And there are times when things don't work. I mean, exorcism, stroke, deliverance doesn't work for poltergeists, but I think we're starting to understand the poltergeist phenomena from an energy perspective as we're getting more and more used to or more advanced scientific tools to be able to measure this sort of thing.
Absolutely. Man, I was just looking at our time, man.
You've got to go.
I've got to go watch Godzilla at 1 o'clock. So
oh, my goodness.
So I'm a little tight on the old time, but yeah, I'm going to be fine. I'll get there just fine. Because I'm sure there's going to be 15 minutes of adverts, so it's all right.
Oh, there will, at least.
In fact, when I went to see... what was it? Was it Last Avengers? That was a good, like, 25 minutes of adverts of the movie. So prior to the trailer starting, there was 25 minutes of just adverts. And it's like, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
So it's like an hour later, almost, before this movie actually started, so... I'm sure
my kids take the mickey because I'm normally through the sweets before the adverts are finished.
Yeah, the popcorn's almost all gone. Yeah. Look, so Matt, can we come back to this conversation? I think there's a few more things we can tickle in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Tickle away.
Absolutely. So, like, Matt, I'll leave you now. Just want to give us an iteration of your website, have some social media contacts. We'll round up now. We're going to revisit this in the future.
Okay. My blog is www.godofgreenhope.com or www.mattarnold.co.uk. They're both linked to the same thing. And you'll find on there some of the stuff about Forest Church that I do. There's a little bit of Psy stuff that I put on Psychic Jesus. That actually is going to be developed. I didn't want to put it on any further because I didn't want to self-plagiarize when I come to write my dissertation. There's a lot of stuff in there that I think quite a few of your readers will find quite interesting.
All right, dude, that sounds fantastic, man. Look, Matt, it's been great. I'm going to contact you very soon. I'm going to get out of here and go watch Godzilla. So
indeed, go for it. Take care.
I'll see you soon, man. Take care.
See you soon. Bye.
Thank you very much for taking the time out to join me here today. I really do appreciate it. But if I could just ask one more thing of you, you could just press like, dislike, leave a comment, or press subscribe. You could do any on all of those things, but it allows me to know whether I'm producing the kind of content that you want to listen to. I do produce a variety of content, especially on YouTube and out into the world of social media. So please, if you would, thank you very much. I'm Christian Lander. Until next time.